So tonight I'm going to continue in this series of talks on the 10 paramis. And tonight I want to talk about the third of the 10. Remember the first two, we were sort of talking about living how we live in the world. Now we're starting to talk. This one is sort of halfway between sort of about living in the world and also about practice. And it's renunciation. I subtitled this The Art of Letting Go, which I think is a good way to think of it. The thing about renunciation is it has sort of a bad rap reputation. It's like, oh, renunciation. It's so serious and it sounds sort of grim, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that at all. And that's basically what this whole talk's going to be about, is that renunciation is actually quite a wholesome, pleasurable thing. And I want to actually start just by reading a little something. This is a book called Parami, my Ajahn Susito. And he says something here that I think is really germane to what I was just saying. This takes us to the third perfection, which is generally translated as renunciation. This practice is a matter of wise discernment rather than asceticism or being puritanical, which is often where the rap about renunciation comes. It's like, oh, it's so serious. And, puritanical is probably a good word for it. Put it simply, renunciation means discerning what one actually needs at any given time within the range of wants and desirables, and following on from that, you could call it simplification. And I like that idea that renunciation is about simplifying your life. Because if as you simplify your life, of course you have more space and time for practice. So let's call this. I'll try and say every time I come across renunciation, I'll try and say simplification instead. I think it's a perfect way to think about it. Anyhow, so as I was saying, the first two paramis, generosity and virtue, dana and sila, sort of prepare us for this. It's like we're leading a life that is focused on being wholesome, essentially. And so now as that we want to apply that wholesome energy to the practice. And first of all, leading the life of generosity and virtue in and of itself is a matter of renunciation in some senses, because it's not normally how people live in this world. It's not something that is that common, actually. So even there, we're sort of going against the stream of our culture, right? Because our culture basically glorifies getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable, which is essentially the opposite of renunciation in some ways. And basically, renunciation requires that you renounce some of what is commonly believed to be the source of happiness or the sources of happiness, simply accumulating things and seeking pleasure. Not that owning many things and experiencing pleasure is bad or wrong. I want to make that very clear also. That's another thing. Often when people talk about renunciation, it's like there's this sort of wagging finger about, oh, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And I'm not talking about that. I don't want to go. Basically, the thing about accumulating things and seeking pleasure is that in the end, it doesn't work. In terms of making us truly happy, it just doesn't work. There's lots of moments of happiness, but as a solution to the bigger problems in our lives, it's just an unsatisfactory way to find happiness. And some of the things I want to read tonight are from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And I've got little stickers in here to remind me of the right pieces. So this is He's talking about what I just was mentioning. And so this is what he has to say. The question for us is how to put this step on the path into practice. One discourse on of the middle length discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya, called The Two Kinds of Thoughts, the Buddha suggests one way to begin. Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our minds. It's not just like classify things. It's like think about it. It takes some contemplation almost. We can notice which thoughts are rooted in desire, ill will, or cruelty. Consciously reflect on the karma that they cause, and then abandon them, letting them go. And we can notice those thoughts inclining towards renunciation, goodwill, and compassion. Reflect on their value, and then strengthen them in our lives. All of this is wise reflection in the service of the path. So part of renunciation is you can't renounce until you look and see what it is you need to renounce, in a way, right? You can start to see, oh, these patterns, these ways of being, these patterns of thought lead towards unwholesomeness. That's what I can renounce. As we become more mindful of these two classes of thoughts, we also become more aware of the strength and seductive power of the unwholesome patterns. Ill will and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed and desire, but easier to uproot, whereas desire is less dangerous but harder to uproot. Why is this? Ill will has more harmful consequences, but it is always unpleasant, and the suffering of it is obvious. So being angry, being full of ill will, just, you know, just you can feel it in your body. That it's like, ugh, that ugh factor is going to be there. Sense desire, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure, and it's not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. It's interesting. I think I thought this was really interesting when I was preparing for this talk, this idea that ill will is easier to give up. Anger is easier to give up than things that are based on pleasure, that we normally think of as pleasurable. And he goes on in this section. There's a section here called Recognizing Our Own Addictions. Very apropos. But a more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be the experience of non-addiction. So there's another definition of renunciation, non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they might be. We might be addicted in one way or another to food, drugs, sex, alcohol, or perhaps more unnoticed to work, power, recognition, wealth, or even comfort. We can become addicted to and entranced by certain mind states and emotions, like excitement or intensity of fear. Meditators can also get addicted to different meditative states, like rapture or calm. How often in our practice are we trying to recreate some experience we've had before? We can get addicted to investigation. We can become overly fascinated with everything we're discovering. And he has this great story. At one point in my practice in Burma, when I had been there for several months, the mindfulness had become very sharp, and I was seeing extremely minute details about what was arising. When I reported this to Sayada Upanditas, who we were studying with, thinking that things were going very well, all he said was, "You're too attached to subtlety." Can you imagine having this really feeling like you really got someplace, and the teacher says, "You're too attached to subtlety"? It was such a powerful reminder that the practice is about renunciation, about letting go. Everything in our practice is in the service of that. It's best summed up in one line of the Diamond Sutra, develop a mind that clings to nothing, doesn't cling to anything. Develop a mind that doesn't cling to anything. So, what he's talking about here is the idea that we're renouncing all these things where we think, even the idea that we think we're doing great, which, when you first think about it, it's like, what? He wants us to, but it's like, those things can become a trap. They can become like, oh, I finally, how many times do we in this practice go, oh, I finally got it all figured out. I finally know what this is all about. And we get all excited, like, ah, I finally got it. That means you stop looking, you stop paying attention because you've got it all figured out, right? This is the opposite of where we want to be. We want to always be receptive to what's arising. Once we think we've got it figured out, one thing we think everything's great, then the incentive to keep practicing deeply isn't there anymore. Anyhow, so the thing about this practice is, as soon as we actually decide to take the practice seriously, you are faced with decisions. It's inevitable. As soon as you decide I'm going to have a regular practice, whether it's sitting or study or some combination of both, or going on retreat, you then go, well, what do I have to give up so that I'll have time to do that? Am I gonna get up earlier? Am I gonna, not spend so much time reading the New York Times in the morning? Whatever it is you're choosing, these things, we have to look at our life and go, oh, this has to go, so there's room for this now. Because all of us have busy lives, whether we're busy working with jobs and or like me, retired. I'm astounded how busy my life is sometimes. I'm supposed to be retired, right? Ha ha ha. It just doesn't work that way. There's always something to do. Like I have an ongoing list. This is my to-do list is short right now. I've only got one thing left on it, but I'll think of three things to put on it tomorrow, right? So it'll be okay. There'll always be something there. But so it's like if you're going to wake up in the morning with a clear mind so you can practice every morning, then you start going to bed a little earlier, perhaps foregoing that party that all your friends wanted you to go on. And you went, no, if I go to that party, I know I'll be up till 2. I'll probably get a little wild. And then I won't be able to get up in the morning. I won't be able to practice. Oh, okay. Well, there's the choice. I'm making it. There's those choices we start to make. If you're starting to sit longer, when you decide you want to sit some longer retreats, well, that's like, especially if you're still working and you've got like, 3 weeks vacation or something like that. Well, but you're going to take a week of that, quote, vacation time to go sit silently at a retreat center instead. That's giving up something. That's renouncing going and lying on the beach or going home and hanging out with your own buds or whatever it is you wanted to do on your vacation. It's like we start to see how we have to let things, some things go, so we have more room for practice. And that's just the nature of renunciation. It's not like we're not punishing ourselves. We're actually going, oh, look at this, I can do this instead and it'll be great. I want to do that longer retreat, or I want to spend more time every day practicing, or however you look at it. It's a shift in our priorities, I suppose. It's simplifying our lives in some ways, but it's also like I'm shifting things, I'm moving things around. And basically, renunciation arises, I think, quite naturally out of the understanding that practice is the more important than most other things in our life. It's a pretty bold statement to say, but I think it's actually true that practice is more important than most other things in our life. That's what makes renunciation easy. Oh, because this is what's more important. This is from a verse from the Dhammapada. The path to material gain goes one way, the way of unbinding another. Realizing this, the monk, a disciple of the Awakened One, should not relish offerings, should cultivate in seclusion instead. Don't. So it's just practice. That's what we relish. The thing is, this might sound difficult or even unpleasant, right? We're back to that renunciation being unpleasant idea. In contrast, the Buddha often talked about the joy of renunciation. It sounds like an oxymoron, right? The joy of renunciation. It's a letting go, a release of things that we've come to see as not important or even useful. I don't need that anymore. You know, it's a result of right understanding, you know, of oh, this is what's important. I've seen that some things we do in our daily life don't lead towards enlightenment, don't lead towards true happiness, but instead sort of weigh us down or hold us back. The way of having to do things like everyone else. Oh, there's the cultural thing, right? We have to do things like everyone else. The desire to be normal, whatever that is, right? Those thoughts just get undone by renunciation. We're renouncing those ideas. How about that? We're renouncing the idea that we have to be like everyone else and we have to be normal. Whew, what a relief that is to renounce that. You can renounce that artificial need to conform, that feeling that you don't measure up to some impossible standard of perfection that our culture is just deeply pervaded with. You know, somehow we are always told, well, we're not good enough. You're not perfect yet. You give up that idea completely. You give up the idea that perfection is even worth thinking about, let alone striving for. You also renounce the idea that I can't do that. You know, often that's what holds us back. It's like, oh, I can't do that. I can't be a serious practitioner. I can't do more practice. It's just a thought. It's just a thought in the head. And you renounce that idea itself. And the sense that I can't work towards enlightenment, that I'm not good enough somehow. Just renounce that. Let that go. These are wholesome things. This is a wholesome action. This is renouncing that. These things that are just holding us back. On the other hand, the yellow warning flag is being waved here. Renunciation can't be forced. It can easily become just another desire, even a desire to conform to some standard set by your particular choice of religion or spiritual practice. You know, it's like, well, if you're going to do this, you got to meditate 4 hours every day. And you get that into your head as like, well, that's what I expected, and now I have to conform to this expectation. Now you're just going to make yourself miserable. I mean, maybe for some people, meditating 4 hours every day would be great. It would be very difficult in daily life of a householder life. So if you take on too much too soon, if you get the idea that, well, I'll just renounce everything, and then everything in my life will be happy and perfect, it'll be magically okay, then you'll get a rude shock, basically, because the mind will rebel. The mind will go, no, not a chance. And actually often, and I've seen this in people more than once, you know, people get into this deep idea, I'm just going to renounce everything, I'm going to become this very pure, blah, 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 and they sort of are forcing themselves into it because they think it'll be good for them, right? And at a certain point, they just go wild. They swing way over on the other side of the pendulum. It's just because they've pushed way too hard, and then it's like a rebound. So renunciation has to be a really a gradual process, reinforced by your practice. It's like you have to take this a little bit at a time. However, this is another thing from Joseph that I found this, and I went, oh, this is a really interesting thing. This is once again from his book. Here he says, calls this section called Practice the Wisdom of No. There are also a practice of renunciation called the wisdom of no. So often in spiritual practice, we emphasize yes. Yes to acceptance, openness, richness, fullness of experience. And this yes is an effective antidote to the patterns of self-judgment, contraction, and limitation that infect people in our culture. But there's also the wisdom of no, when we recognize that some things are not skillful, not helpful, not leading to happiness. At those times, we practice saying, no thanks, I'll pass. It's important to understand what this restraint means, because it lies at the heart of our practice. Practicing the wisdom of no is a great art, and we need to learn how to do it in a loving and wise way. In other words, it can't be with that shaking finger energy. Restraint doesn't mean pushing things away or denying their presence. It does not mean being judgmental or having aversion towards certain aspects of our experience. So once again, it's like we have to be careful that we don't get caught in, especially, you know, often there's things we don't like about ourselves, and we are very averse to even dealing with them or thinking about them, and we try and push them away, like, oh, I'm not like that. I'm going to be pure instead. You know, not accepting who we are, not accepting that we all have a dark side. We know, not accepting that none of us are perfect. And so we have to sort of balance, be careful that no isn't the wagging finger no. Like, I'm supposed to be better than I am energy that often arises. So on retreat, renunciation takes up goes to a deeper level, has a deeper meaning, I think. Even if the retreat's just for a day or even half a day, you know, your own practice at home for 4 hours retreat, which people do. Basically, what we're renouncing when we go on retreat is everything that we usually do to distract ourselves. All those things we do to distract ourselves and keep ourselves busy. The things that we do so we don't have to deal with all the mental and emotional baggage we push away and deny. You know, to practice noble silence, not even reading or writing, so that the mind's habit of glossing over things with words is exposed. Because that's what happens when we're really on a retreat, especially the longer you retreat, the more this becomes obvious, how much we depend on words all the time. How we explain things to ourselves. How we think, oh, well, it's okay if I read this spiritual book, but now we're caught in the world of words again. And it's like, the thing about it is the function of the mind that comprehends language and words through reading or speech is just, we basically on retreat, we sort of shut that part of the mind down. And let the intuitive, more wisdom-oriented part of the mind rise up and take control more. That's what we're doing. That's why silence is so important, because we're trying to shut down that habit of always going back to words to explain everything and figure everything out. Because the truth is that with this practice, in the end, there's no words that explain it. I mean, I can sit here and talk all for an hour, but I can't really explain it. I can sort of hint about it and point towards it somehow or other. There's also there's no TV and no computers and no music and no cell phones, nothing to distract yourself. So that basically you're left on retreat, you're left with nothing but what's arising in your mind and body in that moment. That's all there is. That's all you have. There's nothing else there that you can use to distract yourself. There's no cooking, no shopping, no deciding what you're going to eat, because the retreat cooks this great food and put it there. Or if you're on, even if you're on a day-long retreat, well, you pack your lunch in the morning, and at noon it's time to eat on a day-long retreat. You're not, oh, well, I think, gee, I don't feel like this sandwich. I'm going to go. Well, you can't go make something else. That's what you got. You got what you brought. It's like you're giving up that sense of being able to do what you want. So basically, on retreat, there's only one decision you ever get to make. It's really interesting. I've noticed this. You can stay awake and continue practicing, or you can go to sleep. That's the only decision that's left you. If so, it's in a day long, the decision might be I can walk away. But basically, that's all that's left. It's like my teacher would often say, like with the, on retreats, there's sort of a formal schedule of, well, you do this, and here's it this time and this time, and then at a certain point in the evening, it's like, now this is the last sit of the evening, right? And Guy was always saying to me, well, after that last sit, if you're still wide awake, keep sitting. Why go? W just because it's quote time to go to sleep, if you're not tired, why bother? Why not just keep on practicing until you start? Oh, I'm gonna fall over now. I better go, go get into my bed before I fall over. Why not just keep going? It's like that's the don't like that's really the decision. Am I going to stay awake and practice more, or am I going to go sleep? There's another. This is sort of some of this is sort of related tangential, just tangentially. What's the word? And here, Joseph is talking about how we think we can't let things go, how we can't renounce things, because they're the things that make us happy. Who wants to renounce stuff that makes you happy, right? He calls this the hallucination of perception. It's taking what is suffering or unsatisfactory to be happiness. Most of what we call happiness is the enjoyment of sense pleasures. We spend so much time seeking the next hit of pleasant experience or working hard for some future pleasure. But since all pleasures are all impermanent, there is no end to the seeking. Sometimes we're enticed by a minor pleasure that hides a much greater suffering. We see this clearly with various harmful addictions, but in more ordinary ways as well. I recently saw some statistics about how much harm attending loud rock concerts or playing one's MP3, is how old the book is now, I still listen to MP3s, right? At too high a volume does to our hearing. For some reason, we take the damaging volume to be happiness. I remember being at really loud rock concerts, and the thing was to get a, be able to sit really close to the speakers so you could sort of feel the vibration, right? In this hallucination of perception, we're often deluded into thinking that wanting itself is happiness. It's really getting somewhere. Have you experienced the idea that there's something you must have or must do, and then experience an almost obsessive quality in the mind It ceases only when you either get it or the desire goes away. And all the while we think this is happiness, until that moment when we finally stop wanting and feel the relief and ease of that. And somewhat ironically, what the world calls suffering, renunciation, restraint at the sense doors, silence, simplicity, environments with few entertaining distractions, the Buddha calls happiness. Because of the ease, open-heartedness, and peace of mind that they bring. Seen through this hallucination of perception, taking what is ultimately unsatisfying to be satisfying is the basis for a great compassion to arise. It is said that after the Buddha's enlightenment, he was moved to teach by compassion because he saw that all beings seeking happiness, wanting happiness, yet doing the very things that cause suffering, and cutting through our own hallucinations becomes the fuel for bodhicitta, for the wish to awaken in order to help beings find a truer happiness. Wise words from Joseph. Here's the problem, however. I'm trying to show both sides as much as I can. Being on retreat, especially being on retreat, having so little control of what's going on, might even seem kind of frightening. But actually, the totally letting go is like incredibly liberating. You just sort of go with, you know, that phrase, go with the flow. Well, that's what we do. You just go with the flow of what is arising, you know. And with skillful practice, you start to see how the mind works. And the whole form of retreat practice in particular, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give you ourselves, and give ourselves, for that matter, give ourselves the opportunity to really look closely at how the mind works. Because we're not doing anything to distract ourselves, because all that's left is the what's arising in the mind, we have this opportunity to really look at it, really see it for what it is. And we start to see the reactive patterns that drive almost all our actions for a start. We start to see that almost everything we do is simply a reaction to what's arising. Oh, I like that. Grab, grab, grab. Oh, I don't like that. You know, or, oh God, that's boring. You know, those are our three classic reactions, right? And none of them bring happiness in the end. And basically we somehow we start to see how our desire to hold on to things, onto what is pleasant, or what push away what we don't want, allows us to just see that habit pattern. It just repeats itself over and over and over again. That reaction to, yes, I like it. No, I don't like it. Oh God, who cares? We just get caught in that over and over and over again and react to it in some way. We sort of get a deeper understanding of the necessity of practice in our daily life. That's what retreat gives us in a sense. It's like, oh, my God, is this what really goes on in my daily life that I don't even notice because I'm too busy to notice it? That's what happens when we go deeper into the practice. We start to see so clearly that these habit patterns just run our lives. And we start to go, oh, maybe I can shift those habit patterns a little bit, and a little bit, and a little bit. I can renounce following my habit patterns even. And that would probably be a good thing to renounce. Difficult. You know, maybe I want to renounce following my habit patterns quite so much. Would be a good start. And as we do this, as we go deeper into the practice and we practice more, then we just come back to this and we go, oh, what else do I need to let go of? We just start to see over and over again, go deeper in and let go more. That's the cycle of practice, at least in my experience. This is another verse from the Dhammapada. If by forsaking a limited happiness, we would see the abundance of happiness, the enlightened man who would forsake the limited happiness for the sake of the abundant. It's like we see, we know what limited happiness is, and we're extremely familiar with it. And if we could just see that there's some greater happiness, then we'd let go of the lesser happiness. It wouldn't be like, oh God, I gotta let go. Isn't that horrible? It's like, phew, isn't that great? I just let go of that stuff and go for this greater happiness instead. That greater happiness of enlightenment or gradual enlightenment anyway. So renunciation in some senses, this is one other way to look at it. It's sort of what I call, wrote in my notes here, the gateway to right understanding. Renunciation allows us to start seeing really clearly how things are and how shifting our patterns is possible. Just possible. Now we have to, you know, put in the time and the practice to make them shift, but that's like... And this is where the paramis start to shift from emphasis for this, definitely emphasis in our daily life here, but it's also emphasis that leads towards our life on the cushion more. We're starting to shift the focus from how we live in the world to what we do when we sit on the cushion. Or what we do when we're doing walking practice, I suppose. What we're doing when we practice in a formal way. It's a renunciation is the sort of the switch over from, because obviously we have to look at our daily life to know what we need to renounce. So we haven't gone away from daily life completely here, but we're starting to shift towards a pattern that is more oriented towards practice. So the question over and over again is going to arise, well, do I need to renounce that? Do I need to let that go? I can't give you a magic formula for that one. We all have to do that at our own pace, at our own time, you know. And we have, like, you know, we're householders, so we have lives in the world, and we can't sort of just, you know, oh no, I'm just going to renounce my life in the world and go, you know, live like I'm living in a cave. That isn't going to happen either. That doesn't work, you know. We have partners and pets and relatives and friends and responsibilities in the world, and we can't just, oh, I'll let all that go too. And I suppose you could decide to become a monastic. There are monastic groups here in North America, for instance, you could join, but I'm not for one second recommending that, because I would personally make a terrible monk, so I'm not even gonna go there any further. But here's one thing. I love this poem, and this poem sort of talks about what can we renounce in some ways. And this is from Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's from her book called Words Under the Words. And some of you, I'm sure, have heard me read this before, but I love this poem because it talks about what I've been talking about in a beautiful, poetic way. It's called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight, Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in the grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. Sums it all very nicely.